Yes, said Hatch steadily. Very much so. Enlighten me, then. Wherever St. Michael's sword has been, people have died. First the merchant's family, then the monks, and when Occam snaps it up, 80 of his crew die right here on the island. 6 months later, Occam's ship is found drifting just like the merchant ship, with all hands dead. Interesting story, Needleman said. But I don't think it's worth stopping work for me to listen to. This is the 20th century. It has no bearing on us. That's where you're wrong. Haven't you noticed the recent rash of illnesses among the crew? Needleman shrugged. Sickness always occurs in a group of this size, especially when people are becoming tired and the work is dangerous. This isn't malingering we're talking about. I've done the blood work. In almost every case, the white cell counts are extremely low. And just this afternoon, one of your digging team came into my office with the most unusual skin disorder I've ever seen. He had ugly rashes and swelling across his arms, thighs, and groin. What is it? Needleman asked. I don't know yet. I've checked my medical references, and I haven't been able to make a specific diagnosis yet. If I didn't know better, I'd say they were buboes. Needleman looked at Hatch with a raised eyebrow. Black death? Bubonic plague. In 20th century Maine. As I said, I haven't been able to diagnose it yet. Needleman frowned. Then what are you rabbiting on about? Hatch took a breath, controlling his temper. Gerard, I don't know exactly what St. Michael's sword is, but it's obviously very dangerous. It's left a trail of death wherever it's gone. I wonder if we were right, assuming that the Spanish meant to wield the sword against Occam. Perhaps he was meant to capture it. Ah, Needleman nodded, an edge of sarcasm distorting his voice. Perhaps the sword is cursed after all. Streeter, standing to one side, sniffed derisively. You know I don't believe in curses any more than you do, Hatch snapped. That doesn't mean there isn't some underlying physical cause to the legend, like an epidemic. This sword has all the characteristics of a Typhoid Mary. And that would explain why several of our sick crew have bacterial infections, while another has viral pneumonia, and yet another a weird infection of the teeth. Just what kind of epidemic might this be, Doctor? Hatch looked at the lean face. I know the diversity of diseases is puzzling. The point is, the sword is dangerous. We've got to figure out how and why before we plunge ahead and retrieve it. Needleman nodded, smiling distantly. I see. You can't figure out why the crew is sick. You're not even sure what some of them are sick of. But the sword is somehow responsible for everything.
It isn't just the illnesses, Hatch countered. You must know that a big nor'easter is brewing. If it keeps heading our way, it'll make last week's storm look like a spring shower. It would be crazy to continue.
Crazy to continue, Needleman repeated. And just how do you propose to stop the dig? Hatch paused for a moment as this sunk in. By appealing to your good sense, he said, as calmly as he could. There was a tense silence. No, said Needleman, with a heavy tone of finality. The dig continues. Then your stubbornness leaves me no choice. I'm going to have to shut down the dig myself for the season, effective immediately. How, exactly? By invoking Clause 19 of our contract. Nobody spoke. My clause, remember? Hatch went on. Giving me the right to stop the dig if I felt conditions had become too dangerous.
Slowly, Needleman fished his pipe out of a pocket and loaded it with tobacco. "Funny," he said in a quiet, dead voice, turning to Streeter. "Very funny, isn't it, Mr. Streeter? Now that we're only 30 hours from the treasure chamber, Dr. Hatch here wants to shut the whole operation down."
"In 30 hours," Hatch said, "the storm may be right on top of us."
"Somehow," the captain interrupted, "I'm not at all convinced it's the sword or the storm that you're really worried about. And these papers of yours are medieval mumbo-jumbo, if they're real at all. I don't see why you..."
He paused. Then something dawned in his eyes.
"But yes. Of course I see why. You have another motive, don't you?"
"What are you talking about?"
"If we pull out now, the Lassa will lose its entire investment. You know very well that our investors have already faced 10% overrun calls. They're not going to cough up another $20 million for next year's dig. But that's exactly what you're counting on, isn't it?"
"Don't lay your paranoid fantasies on me," Hatch said angrily.
"Oh, but they're not fantasy, are they?" Needleman lowered his voice further. "Now that you've gotten the information you need out of the Lassa, now that we've practically opened the front door for you, you'd love nothing more than to see us fail. Then, next year, you could come in, finish the job, and get all the treasure. And most importantly, you'd get St. Michael's sword." His eyes glittered with suspicion. "It all makes sense. It explains why, for example, you were so insistent on that Clause 19. It explains the computer problems, the endless delays, why everything worked on the Cerberus but went haywire on the island. You had it all figured out from the beginning." He shook his head bitterly. "And to think I trusted you. To think I came to you when I suspected we had a saboteur among us.
I'm not trying to cheat you out of your treasure. I don't give a shit about your treasure. My only interest is in the safety of the crew."
"The safety of the crew," Needleman repeated derisively. He fished a box of matches from his pocket, removed one, and scratched it into life. But instead of lighting his pipe, he suddenly thrust it close to Hatch's face. Hatch backed off slightly. "I want you to understand something," Needleman continued, flicking out the match. "In 30 hours, the treasure will be mine. But now that I know what your game is, Hatch, I'm simply not going to play. Any effort to stop me will be met with force. Do I make myself clear?" Hatch looked carefully at Needleman, trying to read what was going on behind the cold expression. "Force?" he repeated. "Is that a threat?" There was a long silence. "That would be a reasonable interpretation," said Needleman, dropping his voice even lower. Hatch drew himself up. "When the sun rises tomorrow," he said, "if you're not gone from this island, you will be evicted. And I give you my personal guarantee that if anyone is killed or hurt, you will be charged with negligent homicide." Needleman turned. "Mr. Streeter." Streeter stepped forward. "Escort Dr. Hatch to the dock." Streeter's narrow features creased into a smile.
"You have no right to do this," Hatch said. "This is my island."
Streeter stepped forward and grasped Hatch's arm. Taking a step to the side, Hatch balled his right hand into a fist and shot his knuckles into the man's solar plexus. It was not a hard blow, but it was placed with anatomical exactness. Streeter dropped to his knees, mouth gaping, the wind knocked out of him.
"Touch me again,"
Hatch said to the gasping figure, and you'll be carrying your balls around in a cup.
Streeter struggled to his feet, violence in his eyes.
Mr. Streeter, I don't think force will be necessary, said Needleman sharply, as the team leader moved forward menacingly. Dr. Hatch will return to his boat peaceably. He realizes there is absolutely nothing he can do here to stop us, now that we've smoked out his plan. And I think he realizes how foolish it would be to try.
He turned back to Hatch.
I'm a fair man. You took your best shot, and you failed. Your presence is no longer required on Ragged Island. If you leave, and allow me to finish as we agreed, you'll still get your share of the treasure. But if you try to stop me...
Silently, he swept his hands back and placed them on his hips, pulling his slicker aside in the process. Hatch could clearly see the handgun snugged into his belt.
Well, what do you know? Hatch said.
The captain's strapped.
Get going, said Streeter, stepping forward. I can find my own way.
Hatch backed up to the far wall, and then, without taking his eyes off the captain, he climbed out of the excavation to the base of the array, where the lift was already depositing the first diggers of the next shift.
Chapter 41. The rising sun tore free of a distant bar of cloud and cast a brilliant trail across the ocean, illuminating a crowd of boats packing Stormhaven's small harbor from channel entrance to piers. Chugging slowly through a gap in the center of the crowd was a small dragger, Woody Clay standing at its wheel. The boat veered and almost brushed the pepper can buoy at the head of the channel before steadying and resuming its outward course. Clay was an indifferent sailor. Reaching the harbor entrance, he turned the boat and cut the motor. Raising a battered megaphone, he shouted instructions to the surrounding crowd, his voice full of such conviction that even the ancient buzzing amplification could not distort it. He was answered by a series of coughs and roars as numerous engines came to life. The boats at the front of the harbor cast off their moorings, pulled through the channel, and throttled up. They were followed by more, then still more, until the bay filled with long, spreading wakes of the fleet as it headed in the direction of Ragged Island. 3 hours later, and 6 miles to the southeast, the light struggled down through the mist into the vast, damp labyrinth of braces and cribbing that made up the water pit. It threw a dim, spectral illumination over the complex workings that filled the pit's mouth. At the lowest depths of the pit, 180 feet down, neither day nor night had any relevance. Gerard Needleman stood beside a small staging platform, watching the crew dig feverishly beneath him. It was a few minutes short of noon. Faintly, above the grumble of the air ducts and the clank of the winch chain, Needleman could just make out a clamor of air horns and boat cannon on the surface. He listened for a moment. Then he reached for his portable telephone.
Streeter.
Here, Captain, came the voice from Orthanc, 200 feet above, faint and gravelly through a wash of static.
Let's have your report. About 2 dozen boats in all, Captain. They've formed a ring around the Cerberus, trying to set up a blockade. Guess they think that's where everyone is.
There was a further crackle of static that might have been a laugh.
Only Rogerson's on board to hear them. I sent the rest of the research team ashore last night.
Any signs of sabotage or interference?
No, Captain. They're pretty tame. A lot of noise, but nothing to worry about.
Anything else?
Magnuson's picking up a sensor anomaly at the 64-foot level.
It's probably nothing. The secondary grid shows nothing unusual. I'll take a look.
Needleman thought for a moment.
Mr. Streeter, I'd like you to meet me there.
Aye, aye.
Needleman climbed up the ladder from the dig site to the base of the electric lift, his movements lithe and fluid despite his lack of sleep.
He took the lift up to the 60-foot level, then moved out onto the platform and climbed carefully down the spars to the errant sensor. He verified the sensor was operational and returned to the platform just as Streeter completed the descent down the far side of the array.
"Any problems?" Streeter asked.
"Not with the sensor." Needleman reached over and switched off Streeter's comlink to Orthanc.
"But I've been thinking about Hatch."
There was a squeal of gears, then a mechanical groan from below as the powerful winch pulled another load of dirt and mud up from the dig site. The two men watched as the large iron bucket rose from the depths, condensation gleaming under the harsh lights.
"Only 8 more feet to the treasure chamber,"
Needleman murmured as he watched the bucket recede into the circle of light overhead.
96 inches.
He turned to Streeter. "I want all non-essential personnel off the island. Everyone. Say whatever you want. Use that protest or the storm as excuses if you like. We don't want a lot of extra bodies around rubbernecking during the actual extraction. When the shift changes at 2, send the diggers home too. This next shift should see the job finished. We'll winch the treasure up in the bucket, and I'll carry the sword myself. We need to get it out as soon as possible. Can Rogerson be trusted?"
"He'll do what I tell him, sir."
Needleman nodded. "Bring the Cerberus and my command vessel close to the island, but keep them well clear of the reef. We'll use the launches and split the treasure between the two boats as a precaution." He fell silent a moment, his eyes far away.
"I don't think we're through with him,"
he began again in a low voice, as if his thoughts had never left Hatch. "I've underestimated him all along, and I may be underestimating him now. Once he gets home, he's going to start thinking. He'll realize it might take days, even weeks, to get a legal injunction against us. And possession is 9/10 of the law. He could cry Clause 19 until he's blue in the face. But by that point, everything would be academic." He touched Streeter's lapel. "Who would have thought $1 billion wouldn't be enough for the greedy bastard? He's going to think of a plan. I want you to find out what that plan is. And stop it. We're only hours away from Occam's treasure, and by God, I don't want any nasty surprises before we get to it." He gripped the lapel suddenly. "And for Christ's sake, whatever you do, don't let Hatch set foot on this island again. He could do a lot of damage." Streeter looked back impassively.
"Any particular way you want him handled?"
Needleman released the lapel and took a step back.
"I've always found you to be a creative and resourceful seaman, Mr. Streeter. I leave the matter to your discretion."
Streeter's eyebrows rose momentarily in what might have been anticipation, or perhaps merely a muscle spasm.
"Aye, aye, sir," he said.
Needleman leaned forward and switched the comms set back on. "Keep in touch, Mr. Streeter." Then he was back on the lift and descending once again. Streeter turned back toward the ladder array. In a moment, he too was gone. Chapter 42. Hatch stood on the wide old porch of the house on Ocean Lane. What had been merely a weatherman's threat the day before was fast becoming reality. To the east, a heavy swell was coming in over the sea, creating a torn line of breakers on the reefs of Breed's Point. On the opposite side of the harbor, beyond the channel buoys, the surf flung itself again and again up the granite cliffs beyond Burnt Head Light, the boom of the rollers carrying across the bay in measured cadences. The sky was slung across with the ugly underbelly of a massive foul-weather front, the clouds churning and coiling as they raced across the water. Farther offshore, an evil patch of surf seethed about Old Hump.
Hatch shook his head. If the swell was already smothering the bald rock, it was going to be a hell of a blow. He gazed down toward the harbor, where a few vessels from a protest flotilla were already returning. Smaller boats, and the million-dollar craft of the more cautious trawler captains. Closer to home, movement caught his eye. He turned to see the familiar stubby form of a Federal Express van nosing into the lane, wildly out of place as it bumped down the old cobbles. It stopped in front of his house, and Hatch came down the steps to sign for the package. He stepped back into the house, tearing open the box and eagerly removing the thick plastic packet inside. Professor Horn and Von Terre, standing beside one of the pirate skeletons, stopped talking when they saw the package. "Straight from the Smithsonian's Physanthro Lab," Hatch said as he broke the plastic seal. Pulling out the bulky computer printout within, he laid it on the table and began flipping pages. There was a heavy silence as they leaned over the results, disappointment palpable in the air. Finally, Hatch sighed and flung himself into a nearby chair. The professor shuffled over, eased himself down opposite Hatch, rested his chin on his cane, and eyed Hatch meditatively.
"Not what you were looking for, I take it," he asked.
"No," Hatch said, shaking his head. "Not at all." The professor's brows contracted.
"Malin, you were always too hasty to accept defeat."
Von Terre picked up the printout and began flipping through it.
"I cannot make foot or head of these medical jargon," she said. "What are all these horrible-sounding diseases?"
Hatch sighed.
"A couple of days back, I sent off bone sections from these two skeletons to the Smithsonian. I also included a random sampling from a dozen of the skeletons you uncovered in the dig."
"Checking for disease," Professor Horn said.
"Yes. As more and more of our people began to get sick, I began to wonder about that mass pirate grave. I thought the skeletons might be useful in my examination. If a person dies of a disease, he usually dies with a large number of antibodies to that disease in his body."
"Or her body," said Von Terre. "Remember, there were three ladies in that grave."
"Large labs like the Smithsonian's can test old bone for small amounts of those antibodies, learn exactly what disease the person might have died from."
Hatch paused.
"Something about Ragged Island, then and now, makes people sick. The most likely candidate to me seemed the sword. I figured that somehow it was a carrier of disease. Everywhere it went, people died."
He picked up the printout.
"But according to these tests, no two pirates died of the same illness. Klebsiella, Brunier's disease, dendritic mycosis, Tahitian tick fever. They died of a whole suite of diseases, some of them extremely rare, and in almost half the cases, the cause is unknown."
He grabbed a sheaf of papers from an end table.
"It's just as mystifying as the CBC results on the patients I've been seeing the last couple of days."
He passed the top sheet to Professor Horn.
"The blood works always abnormal, but in different ways with each person. The only similarity is the low white blood cells. Look at this one. 2,500 cells per cubic millimeter. 5 to 10,000 is normal. And the lymphocytes, monocytes, basophils, all way down. Jesus!"
He dropped the sheet and walked away, sighing bitterly.
"This was my last chance to stop Needleman. If there was an obvious outbreak, or some kind of viral vector on the island, maybe I could have persuaded him or used my medical connections to quarantine the place. But there's no epidemiological pattern among the illnesses, past or present."
There was a long silence.
"What about the legal route?"
Von Terre asked. "I spoke to my lawyer. He tells me it's a simple breach of contract. To stop Needleman, I'd have to get an injunction."
Hatch looked at his watch. "And we don't have weeks. At the rate they're digging, we've only got a few hours."
Can't he be arrested for trespassing?
Bonterre asked. Technically, he's not trespassing. The contract gives him and the Lassa permission to be on the island.
I can understand your concern, the professor said, but not your conclusion. How could the sword itself be dangerous? Short of getting sliced open by its blade, I mean.
Hatch looked at him. It's hard to explain. As a diagnostician, sometimes you develop a sixth sense. That's what I feel now. A sense, a conviction that this sword is a carrier of some kind. We keep hearing about the Ragged Island curse. Maybe this sword is something like that, only with a real-world explanation.
Why have you discarded the idea of it being a real curse?
Hatch looked at him in disbelief. You're joking, right?
We live in a strange universe, Malin.
Not that strange.
All I'm asking is that you think the unthinkable. Look for the connection.
Hatch walked to the living room window. The wind was blowing back the leaves of the oak tree in the meadow. Drops of rain had begun to fall. More boats were crowding into the harbor. Several smaller craft were at the ramp, waiting to be hauled out. The white caps flecked the bay as far as the eyes could see, and as the tide began to ebb, a nasty cross sea was developing. He sighed and turned.
I can't see it. What could streptococcal pneumonia and, say, candidiasis have in common?
The professor pursed his lips.
Back in 1981 or 82, I remember reading a similar comment made by an epidemiologist at the National Institutes of Health.
And what was that?
He asked what Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis carinii could possibly have in common.
Hatch turned sharply. Look, this couldn't possibly be HIV. Then, before the professor had gathered himself for an acerbic reply, Hatch realized what the old man was getting at. HIV kills by exhausting the human immune system, he went on, letting in a host of opportunistic diseases.
Exactly. You have to filter out the pestilential noise, so to speak, and see what's left.
So maybe we're looking for something that degrades the human immune system.
I did not know we had so many sick on the island, Bonterre said. None of my people are ill.
Hatch turned toward her.
None?
Bonterre shook her head.
There. You see?
Dr. Horn smiled and rapped his cane on the floor.
You asked for a common thread. Now you have several leads to follow.
He stood up and took Bonterre's hand.
It was very charming to meet you, mademoiselle, and I wish I could stay. But it's coming on to blow, and I want to get home to my sherry, slippers, dog, and fire.
As the professor reached for his coat, there came the sound of heavy footsteps hurrying across the porch. The door was flung open in a gust of wind, and there was Donny Truitt, his slicker flapping open and rain running down his face in thick rivulets. A flash of fire tore the sky, and the heavy boom of thunder echoed across the bay.
Donny?
Hatch asked. Truitt reached down to his damp shirt, tearing it open with both hands. Hatch heard the professor draw in a sharp breath.
Grand Mère du Noir,
Bonterre whispered. Truitt's armpits were spotted with large, weeping lesions. Rainwater ran from them, tinged pinkish green. Truitt's eyes were puffy, the bags beneath blue-black. There was another flash of lightning, and in the dying echo of thunder, Truitt cried out. He took a staggering step forward, pulling the sou'wester from his head as he did so. For a moment, all inside the house were paralyzed. Then Hatch and Bonterre caught Truitt's arm and eased him toward the living room sofa.
"Help me, Mal,"
Truitt gasped, grabbing his head with both hands.
I've never been sick a day in my life.
I'll help, said Hatch. But you need to lie down and let me examine your chest.
Forget my damn chest,
Donnie gasped.
I'm talking about this.
And as he jerked his head away from his hands with a convulsive movement, Hatch could see, with cold horror, that each hand now held a mat of thick, carrot-colored hair.
Chapter 43 Clay stood at the stern rail of his single diesel dragger, the megaphone upended in the fore cabin, drenched and useless, shorted out by the rain. He and the six remaining protesters had taken temporary shelter in the lee of the largest Thalassa ship, a ship they had originally tried to blockade. Clay was wet to the bone, but a feeling of loss, of bitter, hollow loss, penetrated far deeper than the damp. The large ship, the Cerberus, was inexplicably vacant. Either that or the people on board had orders not to show themselves. Despite boat horns and shouts, not a single figure had come on deck. Perhaps it had been a mistake, he thought miserably, to target the largest ship. Perhaps they should have headed for the island itself and blockaded the piers. That, at least, was tenanted. About 2 hours before, a series of launches had left the island, loaded with passengers, angling directly away from the protest flotilla toward Stormhaven at high speed. He looked toward the remnants of his protest flotilla. When they had left the harbor that morning, he'd felt empowered with the spirit, as full of conviction as he'd ever felt as a young man, maybe more. He had been certain that, finally, things would be different for him and the town. He could do something at last, make a difference to these good people. But as he gazed about at the six bedraggled boats heaving in the swell, he admitted to himself that the protest, like everything else he had tried to do in Stormhaven, seemed doomed to failure. The head of the Lobsterman's Co-op, Lemuel Smith, threw out his fenders and brought his boat alongside Clay's. The two craft heaved and bumped against each other as the rain lashed the sea around them. Clay leaned over the gunwale. His hair was plastered to his angular skull, giving his already severe appearance a death's head cast. "It's time to head in, Reverend!" the lobster man shouted, grasping the side of his boat. "This is going to be one humdinger of a storm. Maybe when the mackerel runs over we can try again." "By then it'll be too late," Clay cried over the wind and rain. "The damage will be done." "We made our point," said the lobster man. "Lem, it's not about making a point," said Clay. "I'm cold and wet just like you. But we have to make this sacrifice. We have to stop them." The lobster man shook his head. "We're not going to stop them in this weather, Reverend. Anyway, this little nor'easter may do the job for us." Smith turned a weather eye upward and scanned the sky, then turned to the distant land, a mere ghost of blue vanishing into the driving rain. "I can't afford to lose my boat." Clay fell silent. "I can't afford to lose my boat." That was it in a nutshell. They didn't see that some things were more important than boats or money. And perhaps they never would see. He felt a strange tight sensation around his eyes and realized vaguely that he was crying. No matter. Two more tears in an ocean. "I wouldn't want to be responsible for anybody losing his boat," he managed to say, turning away. "You go on back, Lem. I'm going to stay." The lobster man hesitated. "I'd sure feel better if you came in now. You can fight them another day, but you can't fight the ocean." Clay waved his hand. "Maybe I'll land on the island. Talk to Needleman myself." He stopped, hiding his face as he pretended to busy himself about the boat. Smith gazed at him for a moment with creased, worried eyes. Clay wasn't much of a seaman, but telling a man what to do with his boat was an unforgivable offense. Besides, Smith could see something in the Reverend's face, a sudden uncaring recklessness that told him anything he said would be useless. He slapped the gunwale of Clay's boat. "I guess we'd better shove off, then. I'll be monitoring the 10.5 channel, in case you need help." Clay hugged the lee of the Cerberus, engine idling, and stared as the remaining boats headed into the heaving sea, the sound of their diesels rising and falling on the wind. He pulled his slicker tighter and tried to hold himself steady against the deck. 20 yards away, the curving white hull of the Cerberus rose up, rock solid in the water, the swell sliding noiselessly past. Clay mechanically checked his boat. The bilge pumps were running smoothly, jetting fine streams of water over the side. The engine was purring nicely, and he still had plenty of diesel fuel. Now that it had come to this, now that he was alone, the Almighty his sole companion, he felt an odd sense of comfort. Perhaps it was a sin of presumption to expect so much from the people of Stormhaven. He couldn't rely on them, but he could rely on himself. He would wait a little before heading toward Ragged Island. He had boat and time enough. All the time in the world. He watched the remains of the fleet head back toward Stormhaven Harbor, his arms braced hard upon the helm. Soon they were nothing but distant, ghostly shapes against a sodden background of gray. He did not see the Thalassa launch that pulled away from the island, pitching and yawing, the outboard cavitating with each plunge as it struggled toward the boarding hatch on the far side of the Cerberus. Chapter 44 Donnie Truitt lay on the sofa, breathing more calmly now that the 1 milligram IM dose of lorazepam had started to take effect. He stared at the ceiling, blinking patiently, while Hatch examined him. Bonterre and the professor had retreated to the kitchen, where they were talking in hushed tones. "Donnie, listen to me," Hatch said. "When did the symptoms begin to show?"
"About a week ago," Truitt replied miserably. "I didn't think anything of it. I started waking up nauseated. Lost my breakfast a couple of times. Then this rash thing appeared on my chest."
"What did it look like?"
"Red splotches at first. Then it got kind of bumpy. My neck started to hurt, too. On the sides, like. And I started noticing hair in my comb. First just a little, but now it's like I could pull it all out. But there's never been a touch of baldness in my family. We've always been buried with a full head of hair. Honest to God, Mally, I don't know how my wife would take it if I went bald."
"Don't worry. It's not male pattern baldness. Once we figure out what's wrong and take care of it, it'll grow back."
"I sure as hell hope so," said Truitt. "I got off the midnight shift last night and went straight to bed. But I only felt worse in the morning. Never been to a doctor before. But I thought, hell, you're a friend, right? It wasn't like going to a clinic or something."
"Anything else I should know about?" Hatch asked. Donnie grew suddenly embarrassed.
"Well, my... it kind of hurts around my hind end. There's sores back there or something."
"Roll to one side," Hatch said. "I'll take a look." A few minutes later, Hatch sat by himself in the dining room. He had called an ambulance from the hospital, but it would take at least another 15 minutes to arrive. And then there would be the problem of getting Donnie into it. A rural Mainer, Truitt had a horror of going to the doctor, and an even greater horror of the hospital. Some of his symptoms were similar to what other crew members had complained of. Apathy, nausea. But as with the others, there were symptoms Donnie presented that were maddeningly unique. Hatch reached for his battered copy of the Merck Manual. A few minutes of study gave him a depressingly easy working diagnosis. Donnie was suffering from chronic granulomatous disease. The widespread granular lesions of the skin, the suppurative lymph nodes, The all-too-obviously painful perianal abscesses made diagnosis almost unavoidable. But CGD is usually inherited, Hatch thought to himself. An inability of the white blood cells to kill bacteria. Why would it be showing up only now? Putting the book down, he walked back into the living room.
Donnie, he said, let me take another look at your scalp. I want to see if the hair is coming out in clean patches.
Any cleaner and I'd be Yul Brynner.
Truett touched his head with his hand gingerly, and as he did so, Hatch noticed an ugly cut he hadn't seen before.
Lower your hand a moment.
He rolled up Truett's sleeve and examined the man's wrist.
What's this?
Nothing. Just a scratch I got in the pit.
It needs to be cleaned.
Hatch reached for his bag, rummaged inside, irrigated the cut with saline solution and betadine, then smeared on some topical antibacterial ointment.
How did this happen?
Got cut by a sharp edge of titanium, setting that fancy ladder thing into the pit.
Hatch looked up, startled.
That was over a week ago.
This wound looks fresh.
Don't I know it?
Damn thing keeps opening up. The missus puts liniment on it every night, I swear. Hatch took a closer look at it.
Not infected, he said.
Then, how are your teeth?
Funny you should mention it. Just the other day I noticed one of my buck teeth was a bit loose. Getting old, I guess.
Hair loss. Tooth loss. Cessation of the healing process. Just like the pirates. The pirates had other unrelated diseases, but they all had those three things in common, as did some of the digging crew. Hatch shook his head. They were all classic symptoms of scurvy, but all the other exotic symptoms made scurvy impossible. And yet something about it all was damnably familiar. Like the professor said, forget the other diseases. Subtract them all and see what's left. Abnormal white blood cell count. Hair loss. Tooth loss. Cessation of the healing process. Nausea. Weakness. Apathy. Suddenly, it became overwhelmingly clear. Hatch stood up quickly.
Oh, Jesus, he began.
As the pieces flew into place, he stood, thunderstruck, horrified at the implications.
Excuse me a minute, he said to Truett, pulling the blanket up and turning away.
He looked at his watch. 7 o'clock. Just a couple of hours until Needleman reached the treasure chamber. Hatch took a few deep breaths, waiting for a good ground of control to settle beneath his feet. Then he went to the phone and dialed the number for the island's automated cellular routing center. It was down.
Shit,
he muttered to himself. Reaching into his medical bag, he pulled out the emergency radio communicator. All Thalassa channels were awash in static. He paused a minute, thinking quickly, trying to sort out his options. Just as quickly, he realized there was only one. He stepped into the kitchen. The professor had spread out a dozen arrowheads on the kitchen table and was describing coastal Indian sites to Bonterre. She looked up excitedly, but her face fell when she saw Hatch.
Isabel, he said in a low voice, I have to go to the island. Will you make sure Donnie gets on the ambulance and goes to the hospital?
Going to the island?
Bonterre cried.
Are you mad?
No time to explain, Hatch said on his way to the hall closet. Behind him he could hear the rustle of chairs being pushed back as Bonterre and the professor rose to follow him. Opening the closet door, he pulled out 2 woolen sweaters and began shrugging into them.
Malin?
Sorry, Isabel, I'll explain later.
I will come with you.
Forget it, Hatch said. Too dangerous. Anyway, you have to stay here and see that Donnie gets to the hospital.
I ain't going to no hospital,
rose the voice from the sofa. See what I mean? Hatch pulled on his oilskin and stuffed a sou'wester into one pocket.
No. I know the sea. It will take 2 to get across in this weather, and you know it.
Bonterre began pulling clothes out of the closet. Heavy sweaters. His father's old slicker. Sorry, Hatch said, tugging into a pair of boots. He felt a hand laid on his arm.
The lady is right, the professor said. I don't know what this is all about. But I do know you can't steer, navigate, and land a boat in this weather by yourself. I can get Donnie on the ambulance and to the hospital.
Did you hear me? Donnie called.
I ain't getting in no ambulance.
The professor turned and fixed him with a stern look.
One more word out of you and you'll be clapped on a stretcher and strapped down like a madman. One way or another, you are going.
There was a brief pause.
Yes, sir,
Truett answered. The professor turned back and winked. Hatch grabbed a flashlight and turned to look at Bonterre, her determined black eyes peering out from under an oversized yellow sou'wester.
She's as capable as you are, the professor said. More so, if I were being honest.
Why do you need to do this? Hatch asked quietly. In answer, Bonterre slipped her hand around his elbow.
Because you are special, Monsieur le Docteur. You are special to me. I would never forgive myself if I stayed behind and something bad happened to you.
Hatch paused a moment to whisper Truett's treatment instructions to the professor. Then they raced out into the driving rain. In the last hour, the storm had picked up dramatically, and above the howling wind and lashing trees, Hatch could hear the boom of Atlantic rollers pounding the headland, so low and powerful it registered more in the gut than in the ear. They dashed through streaming streets full of shuttered houses, lights gleaming in the premature dark. Within a minute, Hatch was drenched despite the slicker. As they neared the wharf, there was an immense flash of blue light, followed immediately by a thunderous crash. In the aftermath, Hatch could hear the pop of a transformer failing at the head of the harbor. Instantly, the town was plunged into blackness. They made their way along the wharf, carefully stepping down the slick gangplank to the floating dock. All the dinghies had been lashed to the shaking structure. Pulling his knife from a pocket, Hatch cut the Plain Jane's dinghy loose and, with Bonterre's help, slid it into the water.
It might swamp with two, said Hatch, stepping in. I'll come back and pick you up.
You had better,
Bonterre said, comic in the oversized sweater and slicker. Not bothering to start the dinghy's engine, Hatch ran the oars through the oarlocks and rowed out to the Plain Jane. The harbor waters were still relatively calm, but the wind had raised a steep chop. The dinghy was flung up and down, slapping the troughs with unwholesome shudders. As he rowed, his back to the sea, Hatch could see the outlines of the town dim against the dark sky. He found his eyes drawn toward the narrow, tall structure of the rectory, a wooden finger of blackness. There was a flash of livid lightning, and in the brief glare Hatch saw, or thought he saw, Claire, dressed in a yellow skirt, one hand on the open doorframe of the house, staring out to sea toward him, before darkness descended once again. There was a thump as the dinghy nudged alongside his boat. Clipping it to a stern bolt, Hatch clambered aboard, primed the engine, then said a brief prayer and cranked the starter. The Plain Jane sprang to life. As he drew the anchor chain up through the hawse hole, Hatch was once again grateful to have secured such a weatherly craft. He goosed the engine and made a passing swipe at the dock, pleased to see Bonterre leap aboard with a seaman's agility, despite the bulky clothing. She strapped on the life jacket Hatch tossed her, then tucked her hair under the sou'wester. Hatch checked the binnacle and turned his gaze seaward, toward the two light buoys mid-channel and the Pepper Can Bell buoy at the mouth of the bay. "When we hit the open ocean," he said, "I'm going to head diagonally into the sea at half throttle. It's going to buck like hell, so keep hold of something. Stay close by in case I need your help with the wheel."
"You are foolish," said Bonterre, nerves turning her good humor testy. "Do you think storms are found only off Maine? What I want to know is what this insane trip is all about."
"I'll tell you," Hatch said, staring out to sea. "But you're not going to like it."
Chapter 45. Clay peered through the screaming murk, gripping the wheel with aching arms. The boat struck each towering wave with a crashing shudder, water bursting over the bows, wind tearing foam from the crests. Every wave smothered the pilot house windows in white as the dragger tipped and began its sickening descent into the trough. For a moment there would be sudden, windless silence. Then the craft would lift with a sickening lurch and begin the cycle over again. 10 minutes earlier, when he'd tried the forward searchlight, he learned the boat had blown some fuses and lost most of its electrical power. The backup batteries were dead, too. He hadn't checked them, as he knew he should. But he'd been busy with other things. Earlier, without warning, the Cerberus had raised anchor and gotten underway, ignoring his horn, the vast white bulk moving inexorably into the black, lashing sea. Alone, violently tossed, he had followed it for a time, fruitlessly hailing, until it disappeared into the furious darkness. He looked around the cabin, trying to assess the situation. It had been a serious mistake to follow the Cerberus. He realized that now. If they had not heeded him before, they certainly would not stop to heed him now. Besides, out of the lee of Ragged Island, the ocean was literally boiling. The eastbound swell was beating against the outbound tide, creating a viciously steep cross-sea. The Loran was dead, leaving him with the compass in the binnacle as his only navigational tool. He was trying to steer by the compass, using dead reckoning. But Clay knew he was no navigator, and with no light he could read the compass only by lightning flashes. There was a flashlight in his pocket, but Clay desperately needed both hands to steer. Burnt head light was socked in, and the screaming wind and surf were so loud he'd practically have to run over the bell buoy to hear it. Clay wrapped both elbows around the wheel and leaned against it, trying desperately to think. The island was less than a half mile away. Clay knew even a superb mariner would have a difficult job bringing the boat in through the reefs to Thalassa's dock in this weather. But, even if his fierce determination to land on Ragged Island had wavered, it would have been more difficult still to cross the 6 miles of hell to Stormhaven. Twice he thought he heard the deep-throated sound of the Cerberus's engines. But it made no sense. First it was heading east, later heading west, as if searching, or waiting for something. He checked the compass in a flash of lightning, holding the wheel with weakening arms while the boat sagged into yet another trough. He made a slight correction to his course, heading now almost directly into the sea. The boat shuddered its way into another combat, and a sheer wall of black and gray water rose off the bows, higher and higher, and he realized that the correction was, in fact, a mistake. As the wave toppled back down upon the pilot house, the entire boat was jammed downward with a wrenching twist. The tremendous force of the water popped one of the windows from its frame and seawater slammed into Clay. He had just enough time to brace against the wheel and cling with all his might against the blast. The boat shuddered, pressing lower and lower into the boiling sea, and just when he thought she would founder, he again felt the grateful surge of buoyancy. The boat rose until the seas parted and rolled off the deck. As the boat crested and the lightning flashed, he had a brief glimpse of a heaving, storm-flecked ocean. Ahead lay a shadow of calmer water, the lee of Ragged Island. Clay looked up into the black sky and a few words escaped his lips. O Lord, if it be thy will. And then he was fighting the sea again, turning the boat diagonally and leaning against the wheel as another surge of water came crashing through the open window. He rode the swell down, the boat shuddering as it slid into calmer water. Before Clay had time to draw a relieved breath, he realized that the water was calm only in comparison to the tempest that raged beyond. A heavy swell warped around the island from both sides, making a confused sea. But at least now he could turn directly toward the mooring. He pushed the throttle up a tick and listened to the responding rumble of the engine. The increased speed seemed to give the boat a little more stability. It plowed ahead, plunging, surging upward, then plunging again. With the window out and the searchlight dead, he had trouble navigating in those brief moments of vision at the top of the swells. He realized dimly that it might be wise to throttle back, just in case that
There was a stunning crash as the boat bottomed itself against the reef. Clay was thrown violently forward into the wheel, breaking his nose. Then he was tossed back against the far wall of the pilot house. Surf, surging over the reef, slewed the boat sideways. Then a second roller spun the boat full broadside. Clay fought his way back to the wheel, snorting blood and brine, trying to clear his head. Then a third wave slammed the boat over on its beam ends, and he was thrown free of the deck into a perfect chaos of water and wind. Chapter 46. Hatch swung the nose of the Plain Jane into the channel. Behind came a rattling symphony of lines slapping masts as the boats bobbed hysterically at their moorings. The wind was cold, the sky thick with water. He took a taste, as much salt as it was fresh. He'd seen seas like this before in his childhood, but he'd never been foolhardy enough to venture out in them. He took one final look back at the shore, then turned to sea and throttled up. They passed the floating 5 miles per hour and no wake signs, so thrashed by the sea that they hung sideways, as if admitting defeat. Bonterre came up beside him, clinging to the instrument housing with both hands.
"Well?"
she screamed in his ear.
"Isabel, I've been a damn fool," he shouted back. "I've seen those same basic symptoms 1,000 times. It was staring me right in the face. Anyone who's ever undergone radiation treatment for cancer knows what it's all about."
"Radiation treatment?"
"Yes. What happens to those patients? They get nauseated. They lose their energy, their hair. White cell counts go through the floor. Among all the weird ailments I've seen this last week, every one had those points in common."
Bonterre hesitated, eyes wide despite the blinding surf.
"St. Michael's sword is radioactive. Think about it. Long-term exposure to radioactivity kills your bone marrow cells, basically stops cell division. It cripples the immune system, makes you an easy mark. That's why the Thalassa crew had all those exotic diseases that kept distracting me. But the lack of cell division also stops the healing process, causes hair loss. Look at how my own hand has been so slow to heal. Severe exposure leads to osteoporosis and loss of teeth. Symptoms similar to scurvy.
And it might also explain the computer problems."
"What do you mean?"
"Stray radiation causes havoc with microelectronics."
Bonterre squinted at him, rain and seawater streaming across her face.
"But why go out in this murderous storm?"
"We know the sword is radioactive, but that's all we know about it. The thing's been shut up in a lead box, and yet it's still killed everyone who's come in contact with it over the last 700 years. God only knows what would happen if Needleman took it out of the casket. We can't allow that to happen."
As the boat came out of the lee of Burnt Head, the sea slammed into the Plain Jane's hull with brutal ferocity. Hatch shut up abruptly and spun the wheel, trying to take the heading sea at a diagonal. The air around the boat was filled with pulverized water and spindrift. He checked the binnacle, corrected course, and scanned the Loran. Bonterre gripped the rails with both hands, lowering her head against the driving rain.
"But what is this sword, then?"
"God only knows. Whatever it is, it's hot as hell. I, for one, don't want it."
He fell silent abruptly, staring ahead. A white line loomed out of the murk, towering over the top of the boat. For a moment, he wondered if it was a large ship. "Jesus," he muttered, distantly surprised by the matter-of-fact tone in his own voice.
"Look at that."
It was no ship. He realized with horror that it was the breaking top of a massive wave.
"Help me hold the wheel!" he yelled.
Leaning forward, Bonterre clapped both hands on the wheel while he worked desperately at the throttle. The boat rose along the almost vertical face while Hatch gingerly increased the throttle, trying to keep the boat aligned. As the breaking top of the comber struck, there was an explosion of white and a tremendous hollow roar. He braced himself against the mass of water and held his breath. The boat seemed suspended for a moment inside the wave. Then it suddenly broke free and tipped over the crest with a violent corkscrew motion. He quickly eased up on the throttle and the boat sank into the following trough at a sickening speed. There was a moment of perverse, eerie calm as the boat was protected from the wind in the hollow between the waves. Then the next great face of green water, honeycombed with foam, rose up out of the dark before them.
"It'll get even worse beyond Wreck Island," he yelled.
Bonterre didn't bother to answer, clinging to the wheel as the boat lurched toward another crest with a jarring crash. Glancing at the Loran screen, Hatch saw the boat was being carried southeastward by a riptide at a good 4 knots. He corrected course to compensate, one hand on the throttle and the other on the wheel. Bonterre helped steady the helm through the dips.
"The professor was right," Hatch shouted. "I couldn't have done this without you."
The spray and wind had pulled Bonterre's long hair loose from her sou'wester, and it streamed behind her in a ravishing tangle of black. Her face was flushed. Whether from fear or excitement, he could not tell. Another comber swept over the boat, and he turned his eyes back to the Fury.
"How will you convince Needleman this sword is radioactive?" Bonterre hollered.
"When Thalassa set up my office, they included all kinds of crazy equipment, including a radiologist's rad meter, a high-tech Geiger counter. I never even turned the damn thing on."
Hatch shook his head as they began to climb another wave.
"If I had, it would have gone nuts. All those sick diggers, coming in covered with radioactive dirt. It doesn't matter how much Needleman wants the sword. He won't be able to argue with that meter."
He could just barely hear, over the sound of the wind and his own shouting voice, the distant thudding of surf off the starboard side. Wreck Island. As they came out of the lee, the wind increased in intensity. Now, as if on cue, he could see a massive white line, far bigger than any previous wave, rising up above the Plain Jane. It loomed over their heads, water hissing along its crest. The boat fell into the silent trough and began to rise. His heart hammering in his chest, Hatch gave the boat a little more acceleration as he felt the swell begin to lift them once again.
"Hang on!"
he yelled as the top of the wave reached them. Goosing the throttle, he pointed the boat straight into the roiling mass of water. The Plain Jane was thrown violently backward into a strange twilight world where both air and sea were made of water. Then suddenly they were through, the propeller whining helplessly as the prow fell down the foamy backside of the wave. As they slid into another glassy trough, Hatch saw a second white line materializing out of the gloom ahead, churning and shifting like a mad thing. He struggled with the panic and despair that rose within him. That last hadn't been a freakish wave. It was going to be like this for the next 3 miles. He began to feel an ominous sensation at each twist of the boat. A funny vibration, a tug at the wheel. The boat felt weighty and overballasted. He peered aft through the lashing wind. The bilge pumps had been running at full capacity since they left the harbor, but the old Plain Jane had no well meter. There was no way of knowing the depth of water in the hold without checking it himself.
"Isabel!"
he roared, bracing his feet against the walls of the cabin and locking his hands around the wheel.
"Go into the forward cabin and unscrew the metal hatch in the center of the floor. Tell me how much water's in the hold."
Bonterre shook the rain from her eyes and nodded her understanding. As Hatch watched, she crawled through the pilot house and unlatched the cabin door. A moment later, she emerged again.
"It is 1/4 full," she shouted.
Hatch swore. They must have hit some piece of flotsam that stove in the hull, but he'd never felt the impact in the violent seas. He glanced again at the Loran. 2.5 miles from the island. Too far out for them to turn around. Perhaps too far to make it.
"Take the wheel," he yelled. "I'm going to check the dinghy."
He crawled aft, hanging desperately to the gunwale railing with both hands. The dinghy was still behind, bobbing like a cork at the end of its line. It was relatively dry, the Plain Jane's bulk having kept most of the heavy seas out of it. But dry or not, Hatch hoped to God they wouldn't have to use it. The moment he relieved Bonterre at the helm, He could tell that the boat had grown distinctly heavier. It was taking longer to rise through the masses of water that pressed them down into the sea.
"You okay?"
Bonterre called. "So far," said Hatch. "You?"
"Scared."
The boat sank again into a trough, into that same eerie stillness, and Hatch tensed for the rise, hand on the throttle. But the rise did not come. Hatch waited. And then it came, but more slowly. For a grateful moment he thought perhaps the Loran was off and they had already come into the lee of the island. Then he heard a strange rumble. Towering far above his head was a smooth, Himalayan cliff face of water. A churning breaker topped its crown, growling and hissing like a living thing. Craning her neck upward, Bonterre saw it as well. Neither said a word. The boat rose and kept rising, ascending forever, while the water gradually filled the air with a waterfall's roar. There was a massive crash as the comber hit them straight on. The boat was flung backward and upward, the deck rising almost to vertical. Hatch clung desperately as he felt his feet slip from the deck beneath him. He could feel the water in the hold shift, twisting the boat sideways. Then the wheel went abruptly slack. As the roaring water fell away, he realized the boat was swamped. The Plain Jane came to rest on its side and began to sink rapidly, too full of water to right itself. Hatch looked rearward. The dinghy had also shipped a quantity of water, but was still afloat. Bonterre followed Hatch's eyes and nodded. Clinging to the side, up to their waists in roiling water, they began working their way toward the stern. Hatch knew that a freakish wave was usually followed by a series of smaller ones. They had 2 minutes, maybe three, to get into the dinghy and free of the Plain Jane before she dragged them down with her. Clinging to the railing, Hatch held his breath as the water surged over them, first once, then a second time. He felt his hand grasp the stern rail. Already the eye bolt was too deep underwater to reach. Fumbling about in the chill sea, he located the painter. Letting go of the rail, he reeled in the rope, kicking frantically against the tug of the water until he felt himself bump the dinghy's bow. He scrambled in, falling heavily to the bottom, then rose and looked back for Bonterre. She was clinging to the stern, the Plain Jane now almost under. He grabbed the painter and began pulling the dinghy in toward the eye bolt. Another great wave lifted him up, smothering him with briny foam. He leaned down and grasped Bonterre under the arms, pulling her into the dinghy. As the wave subsided, the Plain Jane turned bottom up and began to sink in a flurry of bubbles.
"We've got to cut loose!" Hatch shouted.
He dug into his pocket for his knife and sawed desperately through the painter. The dinghy fell back into the swell as the Plain Jane turned its stern toward the inky sky and disappeared with a great sigh of air. Without hesitation, Bonterre grabbed the bailer, working fast to lighten the dinghy's bottom. Moving aft, Hatch gave the outboard a tug, then another. There was a cough, a snort, then a tinny rasp above the scream of the ocean. Engine idling, Hatch quickly began working the second bailer. But it was no use. With the Plain Jane gone, the little dinghy was bearing the full brunt of the storm. More water was crashing over the side than could be bailed out.
"We need to be turned against the sea," said Bonterre. "You bail. I will manage the boat."
"But
do it!"
Crawling aft, Bonterre threw the little engine into forward and jammed the throttle open, swinging the boat broadside to the sea as he did so.
"For Christ's sake, what are you doing?"
Hatch howled.
"Bail!" she yelled in return.
The boat sagged backward and upward, the water in its bottom flowing aft. Just as a great comber bore down, she gave the throttle a sudden twist, lifting it up and over. Immediately she turned the boat again, surfing down the wave's backside, almost parallel to the sea. This was in direct opposition to everything Hatch had ever learned about boats. In terror, he dropped the bailer and clung to the gunwale as they gathered speed.
"Keep bailing!"
Bonterre reached back and pulled the stopcock in the stern. Water drained out as the boat picked up even more speed.
"You're going to kill us!" Hatch yelled. "I have done this before," Bonterre shouted. I surfed the waves as a kid. Not waves like this.
The dinghy skimmed down the middle of the trough, the propeller clearing the water with a nasty whine as they began to climb the leading side of the next wave. Sprawled in the bottom and clutching both gunwales, Hatch guessed their speed at 20 knots.
Hold on! Bonterre yelled.
The little boat skidded sideways and skipped over the foaming crest. As Hatch watched in mingled horror and disbelief, the dinghy became airborne for a sickening moment before slamming down on the far side of the wave. It leveled out, shooting down the following edge.
Can't you slow down? It does not work if one slows down. The boat needs to be planing.
Hatch peered over the bows.
But we're heading in the wrong direction. Do not worry. In a few minutes I will come about.
Hatch sat up in the bow. He could see that Bonterre was staying as long as possible in the glassy troughs, where the wind and chop didn't reach, violating the cardinal rule that you never bring your boat broadside to a heavy sea. And yet the high speed of the boat kept it stable, allowing her to look for the best place to cross each wave. As he watched, another wave crested before them. With a deliberate jerk, Bonterre jammed the engine handle around. The dinghy skipped over the top of the crest, reversing direction as it came hurtling down into the next trough.
"Sweet Jesus!"
Hatch cried, scrabbling desperately at the bow seat. The wind dropped a little as they came into the lee of the island. Here there was no regular swell, and it became far more difficult for the little boat to ride the confused sea.
"Turn back!" Hatch cried. "The riptide's going to sweep us past the island!"
Bonterre began to reply. Then she stopped.
"Lights!" she cried.
Emerging from the storm was the Cerberus. Perhaps 300 yards off, the powerful lights on its bridge and forward deck cutting through the dark. Now it was turning toward them, a saving vision in white, almost serene in the howling storm. Perhaps it had seen them, Hatch thought.
No, it had seen them.
It must have picked up the Plain Jane on its scope and been coming to its rescue.
"Over here!"
Bonterre yelled, waving her arms. The Cerberus slowed, presenting its port side to the dinghy. They came to an uneasy rest as the great bulk of the ship cut them off from wind and waves.
"Open the boarding hatch!" Hatch yelled.
They bobbed for a moment, waiting as the Cerberus remained silent and still.
"Vasi! Vasi!"
Bonterre cried impatiently.
"We are freezing!"
Staring up at the white superstructure, Hatch heard the high whine of an electric motor. He glanced toward the boarding hatch, expecting to see it open. Yet it remained closed and motionless. Twisted lightning seared the sky. Far above, Hatch thought he could see a single figure reflected against the light of the bridge instrumentation, looking down at them. The whine continued. Then he noticed the harpoon gun on the forward deck, swiveling slowly in their direction. Bonterre was staring at it also. Puzzled.
"Grand mer du noir,"
she muttered.
"Turn the boat!" Hatch yelled.
Bonterre threw the throttle hard to starboard and the little craft spun around. Above, Hatch saw a peripheral glow, a blue flash. There was a sharp hissing noise, then a loud splash ahead of them. A thunderous whoomp followed, and a tower of water rose 20 feet off their port bow, its base lit an ugly orange.
"Explosive harpoon!" Hatch cried.
There was another flash and explosion, frighteningly close. The little dinghy pitched sharply, then heaved to one side. As they cleared the side of the Cerberus, wild water took them once again. There was an explosion ahead as another harpoon hit the water. Spray stung Hatch's face as they fell backward, nearly foundering. Without a word, Bonterre spun the boat again, throttled up and headed straight for the Cerberus. Hatch turned to yell out a warning, then realized what she was doing. At the last moment, she turned the boat sideways, slamming hard against the huge vessel. They were under the pitch of the hull, too close for the harpoon gun.
"We'll make a dash by the stern!"
Bonterre cried. As Hatch leaned forward to bail, he saw a strange sight. A narrow line in the water, sputtering and snapping, heading toward them. Curious, he paused to watch. Then the line reached the bow in front of him, and with a tearing sound the nose of the dinghy vanished in a cloud of sawdust and wood smoke. Falling into the stern, glancing up, Hatch could see Streeter leaning over the ship's rail, an ugly weapon he recognized as a flechette aimed directly at them. Before Hatch could speak, Bonterre had thrown the boat forward again. There was a sound like a demonic sewing machine as the flechette in Streeter's hands tore apart the water where the dinghy had tossed just a moment before. Then they had cleared the stern and were back out in the storm, the boat bucking, water crashing over the ruined bows. With a roar, the Cerberus began to turn. Bonterre jammed the dinghy to port, almost overturning it as she headed in the direction of the Ragged Island piers. But in the vicious, ripping sea, the small outboard was no match for the power and speed of the Cerberus. Looking through the heavy squall, Hatch could see the huge boat begin to gain. In another minute they would be cut off from the inlet that led through the Ragged Island reefs to the pier beyond.
"Head for the reefs!" he yelled. "If you time the swell, you might be able to ride right over. This boat hardly draws a foot."
Bonterre jerked the boat to a new course. The Cerberus continued to bear down, coming inexorably at them through the storm.
"Make a feint! Let him think we're going to turn at the reefs!" he shouted.
Bonterre brought them parallel to the reefs, just outside the breaking surf.
"He thinks he's got us,"
Hatch said as the Cerberus turned again. There was another shattering explosion off the beam, and for a moment Hatch breathed salt water. Then they emerged from the spray. Glancing down, Hatch saw that half the port gunwale had been blown away by a harpoon.
"We'll only have a single chance," he yelled. "Ride the next swell across."
They bucked along the reef for an agonizingly long instant. Then he yelled,
"Now!"
As Bonterre turned the ruined dinghy into the boiling hell of water that lay across the reef, there came another huge explosion. Hatch heard a strange crunching noise and felt himself hurtled violently into the air. Then everything around him was churning water and bits of planking, and the dying muffled roar of agitated bubbles. He felt himself being drawn down, and still down. There was only one brief moment of terror before it all began to seem very peaceful indeed. Chapter 47 Woody Clay lost his footing on a patch of seaweed, banged his shin, and came close to using the Lord's name in vain. The rocks along the shore were slippery and algae-covered. He decided it was safer to crawl. Every limb of his body ached. His clothes were torn. The pain in his nose was worse than he could have ever imagined, and he was cold to the point of numbness. Yet he felt alive in a way that he had not in many, many years. He'd almost forgotten what it was like, this wild exhilaration of the spirit. The failed protest no longer had any significance. Indeed, it had not failed. He had been delivered onto this island. God worked in mysterious ways, but clearly he had brought Clay to Ragged Island for a reason. There was something he had to accomplish here, something of prime importance. Exactly what, he did not yet know. But he was confident that at the right time, the mission would be revealed to him. He scrambled beyond the high tide mark. Here the footing was better, and he stood up, coughing the last of the seawater from his lungs. Every cough sent a hideous pain shooting through his ruined nose. But he did not mind the pain. What was it St. Lawrence had said when the Romans were roasting him alive over a brazier of hot coals? "Turn me over, Lord. Cook me on the other side." As a child, when other boys had been reading Hardy Boys mysteries and biographies of Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb, Clay's favorite book had been Fox's Book of Martyrs. Even today, as a congregational minister, he saw nothing wrong in quoting liberally from the lives of the Catholic saints, and even more liberally from their deaths. Those were people who had been blessed with visions, and with the courage to see them through, no matter what the cost. Clay was reasonably certain he had the courage. What he'd been lacking recently, he knew, was the vision. Now he had to take shelter, get warm, and pray for the revelation of his purpose. He scanned the shoreline, gray against a black sky, blasted and pelted by the fury of the storm. There were some large rocks off in the dimness to his right, the kind fishermen called whalebacks. Beyond was the unnatural dry lagoon formed by Thalassa's cofferdam. Except the exposed seabed was not entirely dry. He noted, with a grunt of satisfaction, that the surf was battering the cofferdam relentlessly. Several of the stanchions were bent, and one of the reinforced concrete slabs had warped. Every blow of the waves sent massive plumes